truth, message of, and it is a warning.
So I'm Alexander Dugin. I consider myself a philosopher before anything else. I am Russian Christian Orthodox. I was born in Moscow in a typical Soviet family. They were typically Soviet, and I, from the early youth, converted in anti-Soviet vision, world vision. I have discovered traditionalism, and I think that as one of my beloved philosophers, traditionalist Julius Evola, has said once, my biography is my bibliography. Mm-hmm. I consider myself much more than a living person, rather a text. I have written myself as a person, so I have entered in the church. I have formed my political, religious, philosophical ideas. I have preferred to be Christian as my people, as my society. I have great respect for Islam, for Islamic tradition.
Understand where we are in the world, we need to put all the processes, all the events in a larger context. What kind of order they have brought to the Middle East, to the Libya, to the Iraq, to Afghanistan, to Syria? Total destruction, total devastation, chaos and blood and death. No dream.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
How is your faith guiding you?
My faith sustains me because I pray daily. I pray for guidance. Thank you for your questions. Good night.
And we've seen in Iraq, did the United States bring freedom and liberation to Iraq? No, they succeeded in killing an estimated 650,000 people, making refugees out of 3 million, destroying the country and actually strengthening the hand of fundamentalists. So it's increased the nightmare of the Iraqi people.
Yeah, that's true. What's going on? How you feeling?
I'm feeling pretty good right now. It's been a pretty exciting day.
Yeah, getting kills out here.
We did get some cases.
Today, just for documentation, today was the day we went against order, and we shot anyway. And we killed, like, a whole bunch of people.
24 yeah. Unapproved rounds.
Yep. 24 unapproved high-explosive mortar rounds. That's about 40,000 pounds of death right there.
Yep. Yep. It's like a raid in here almost.
Yeah, all I gotta say, actually, you know what, I do have something to say.
Let's hear it.
I love the fucking Marine Corps. I know many
you got you on camera saying it.
I know many of you don't, but what we did today.
Hey, we need born killers like you.
Oh. We're all born killers.
Iraq War and occupation of Afghanistan. That was the deeds of wounded dragon already. And Libya and Syria.
But they felt that Iraq would be a good first step after Afghanistan to establish themselves in the region and from there take on Iran, take on Syria, forcibly crush the Palestinian struggle, strengthen Israel as a regional gendarme, and so on. But the irony is that Iraq has boomeranged. Iraq has actually weakened U.S. power in the region, strengthened Iran's power, and in that way actually added to the necessity they feel to take Iran down.
Iraq and Afghanistan and Colombia are used to wash money out of the U.S. tax base and back.
Arms companies,
yeah.
I mean, what you're saying is that money and money-making is at the center of modern war, and it's almost self-perpetuating.
Yes, and it's becoming worse.
We're in the Ministry of Defense in Whitehall. Behind these doors, there's a room. A room which few people, apart from Arab sheikhs and other potential foreign customers, have ever set eyes on before.
This way, please.
This is it. The Permanent Defense Equipment Exhibition. The supermarket of the sales organization, which this year will sell nearly £600 million worth of British military hardware to foreign governments. Week in, week out, overseas service chiefs come here discreetly to shop for anything from guided missile destroyers and aircraft to a pair of army boots. And they've got quite a choice. There are hundreds of individual British manufacturers in this business. Glossy colored brochures in every language, including, of course, Arabic. Everywhere in this amazing exhibition, there are models showing the hardware in action, showing what the hardware can do. Big missiles, little missiles. Here's the short blowpipe surface-to-air missile with which one soldier can bring an aircraft out of the sky straight from the shoulder. More missiles here, the short Tiger Cat missile, simple in operation, recommended for its high lethality at low cost.
You're targeting people for the Americans.
Yes, we will arrest and interrogate and release if they have not seen it. That's our business.
And when these American operations kill innocent people, what's the impact?
America knows war. They are war masters. They know better than me. So when they funded a war, they know how to fund it. They don't need even to touch, to tell them. They know very well. They are teachers, great teachers.
We went to war in large part because of the concern that weapons of mass destruction in the hands of the Saddam Hussein regime, a regime that used such weapons, in particular nerve gas,
and was supplied by the United States and Britain with these weapons of mass destruction.
No, I don't believe that's accurate.
Well, yes, they were. Most of the weapons of mass destruction from Saddam Hussein weren't built by him. The machine tools and the ingredients for his biological weapons, they all came from other countries, many of them from this country and Britain.
I don't think that's right. I really think
it's on the record in the Library of Congress.
I think the premise of your question is wrong.
Why is it wrong for dictators and terrorists to kill innocent civilians, and right or excusable for the United States to do exactly the same?
Well, the United States doesn't do it, and if we did it, it would be as reprehensible as what the terrorists do.
The United States doesn't kill innocent civilians.
No, the United States does not target civilians.
Mr. Fife, that sounds fine, sitting here in Washington. But in Iraq and in Afghanistan, which is my most recent experience, that's not how it looks at all.
May I interrupt for a moment? I apologize, sir. Would you stop tape, please, for one moment? Thank you very much. Let me know when you stop tape.
Excuse me?
I'm sorry. I'm doing this purpose, please, sir. Have we stopped tape?
This picture, truly one of the most unusual ever filmed, contains scenes which under no circumstances should be viewed by anyone with a heart condition or anyone who is easily upset. We urgently recommend that if you are such a person or the parent of a young or impressionable child now in attendance, that you and the child leave the auditorium.
We Americans know, although others appear to forget, the risk of spreading conflict. We still seek no wider war.
The United States does not start fights. America does not seek conflict.
I don't like to use military force.
Our nation enters this conflict reluctantly.
Good morning, Vietnam.
We want nothing for ourselves, only that the people of South Vietnam be allowed to guide their own country in their own way.
The United States has been engaged in an effort to stop the advance of communism in Central America by doing what we do best, by supporting democracy.
America will stand with the Allies of Freedom to support democratic movements in the Middle East and beyond, with the ultimate goal of ending tyranny in our world.
I am continuing and I am increasing the search for every possible path to peace.
Freedom and peace. No one, friend or foe, should doubt our desire for peace.
The United States wants peace.
I pledged in my campaign for the presidency to end the war in a way that we could win the peace.
We seek peace. We strive for peace.
There's something really weird here. The truth, fact is fiction, fiction is fact, war is peace, peace is war. What the hell's going on here?
If this little nation goes down the drain and can't maintain her independence, ask yourself what's going to happen to all the other little nations.
Gaining control of this Middle East, Central Asian region, knocking down any obstacles, whether they be in the form of anti-U.S. movements or states such as Iraq, Iran, Syria that weren't firmly under U.S. control. Once having done this and gained control of this region, Bush, Cheney, and company felt this would put the United States in a position, it would be a key element of preventing the rise of any challenger to U.S. power globally or regionally. And of course, the two main countries they've been worried about are Russia and China. Now, this is something that these people conceive of as essential to the functioning of U.S. capitalism and to the continuation of the United States' role as the world's leading superpower.
In order to dominate the world, we must control the world's oil, and we must not tolerate countries that show how independence and defiance of the U.S. is possible. Plain and simple, the U.S. agenda is world domination.
In order to fight with them, you should develop, you should get stronger, you should be innovative in some way. And if we want to oppose to this liberalism, we shouldn't fall into communism or into fascism. And we need to imagine something other. That's something other I'm calling fourth political theory. What is this context? That is shift from unipolar world system to the multipolar world system. To overcome Western-centered political thought, to get out from Western-centered political thought, and as example, Iranian revolution. Velayat-e Faqih is not liberal, obviously, is not communist, is not fascist or nationalist. Something completely different, outside of political modernity. But I suggest to find the same fourth political theory for Europe, for Latin America, for Arab world, for Russia, for China, for everybody else. So Iran is the only one country that has identified something positive in that. But it is limited to Iranian and Shia world. But fourth political theory is much larger. We have different identity. Christian is Muslim, Shia, Sunni. We should not confuse them. We should not mix them. We should recognize and respect the other in positive way, not in negative way. That is multipolarity, multiplicity of the dreams. We have theological differences, and the enemy, the wounded dragon, tries to play on that. They try to provoke the fitna between Shia and Sunni, between Christians and Muslims, between Hindu and Muslim. And they succeed sometimes. But in order to come to multipolarity, we should learn to respect the differences in positive way. So we are coming to the multipolar world, and nobody could understand what will be this multipolar world, because I think it started, this transition, clearly stated with the beginning of 2000, with Putin, with 9/11, with Chinese growth, and now we are living precisely in this transition. And this transition becomes each day clearer and clearer and clearer and clearer. It could be very, very difficult transition. Unipolarity does not want to let alternative world order to appear. And multipolarity appeared as alternative to this destruction, to this chaos in the Middle East. So we are dealing with the wounded dragon of Western liberalism, Western hegemony, capitalism, that doesn't want let us to create alternative world order. It resists, but it is on decline.
It is time to show the whole world that America is back, bigger and better and stronger than ever before. We don't have victories anymore.
Iran shot down an unmanned U.S. military drone like this one.
President Trump saying today that the American people will soon find out if the United States is going to war with Iran, saying the regime made a very big mistake shooting down a U.S. military surveillance drone over the Strait of Hormuz.
I have a feeling that it was a mistake made by somebody that shouldn't have been doing what they did. I find it hard to believe it was intentional, if you want to know the truth. I think that it could have been somebody who was loose and stupid that did it.
Iran's Revolutionary Guard releasing its own video showing what it says is the moment of the shootdown.
So Iranian revolution and today's resistance in Holy Land, it is the path of this fight against unipolar world, against global domination of the West. First of all, China didn't get to the final capitalization and liberalization. Chinese accepted something from globalization and rejected the other aspect. We see the other example, our Russia. Putin has changed the course of our history. He stopped Yeltsin's course and started to reaffirm Russia as sovereign country with Christian Orthodox identity. At the same time, Iran stood strong against all their pressure. Spiritual leadership has saved Iran in that crucial moment. Turkey, that was part of the West, was rejected by the West, wasn't accepted as a part. And Erdogan began to change his position, becoming more and more nationalist in some way, but less and less pro-Western. And in last years, we see that there is the obvious end of this unipolarity. The West started Arab Spring in order to destroy traditional society. And when this process came to the Syria, there was obstacle of Russia, Iran, and somehow Turkey opposing to the Western. In that sense, I think that Iran is
far in front of an avant-garde position comparing to the other, because Vilayati Faqih structure and return to the religion is one step in front of all other. And revolutionary idea of Ayatollah Khamenei obtains now all its meaning.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The UN Security Council's recent authorization of an international stabilization force, the ISF, in Gaza has sparked sharp contention. Supporters frame it as a transitional mission to secure a ceasefire, enable humanitarian relief, and prepare for reconstruction. Critics, though, including Palestinian resistance movements, denounce it as an infringement on self-determination, while the European Union warns against altering Gaza's demographic and territorial integrity and insists on a two-state solution. The spotlight now turns on whether the ISF represents genuine stabilization or a new form of external control. I am Bahman Roy. Let us begin with the report.
The UN Security Council has voted in favor of a U.S. plan for Gaza, including supporting the establishment and deployment of an international stabilization force. Under the adopted resolution, foreign troops will operate under a unified command to secure the territory, oversee its demilitarization, and facilitate aid delivery through safe corridors. The measure passed overwhelmingly. However, major powers, Russia and China, abstained, arguing that the resolution fails to outline a clear role for the UN in Gaza's future and lacks enough detail on how it will be implemented.
In essence, the Council is giving its blessing to a U.S. initiative on the basis of Washington's promises, giving complete control over the Gaza Strip to the Board of Peace and the International Stabilization Force, the modalities of which we know nothing about so far.
The draft resolution is vague and unclear on many critical elements. It should have explained in detail their structure, composition, terms of reference, and criteria of preparation, among others. This should have been an essential basis for the Council's serious discussions. However, the draft resolution contains skimpy details on these critical elements.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has also slammed the resolution, saying in a statement that it does not meet the political and humanitarian demands and rights of the Palestinian people. The group insisted that any international force must operate fully under UN supervision and only in coordination with official Palestinian institutions. Other resistance groups have expressed similar concerns, saying the resolution undermines Palestinians' right to self-determination and that it authorizes the U.S. to establish itself as an occupying power. The concerns are in line with repeated alarms that any initiative for the future of Gaza by the U.S. cannot be trusted by Palestinians. That's because Washington is widely known as an accomplice in Israel's genocidal war on Gaza.
Welcome back. Allow me to introduce my guests. Betul Sobeti, activist and political analyst, joining us from London. And Ajam Mubaraka, founder of the Black Alliance for Peace, joining us from New York in the U.S. Welcome to the program. It's a pleasure to have you. I'm going to start the conversation with Betul here. Betul, how do Palestinian resistance movements interpret the ISF resolution as undermining their right to self-determination?
Yes, let's talk about, you know, the demands of this, you know, so-called peace plan and this, you know, resolution. In terms of where Palestinian power lies, it talks about the reformation within the UN. Within the PA, it talks about, you know, the reconstruction process of allowing aid in. The ISF is supposedly to train Palestinians to disarm the resistance, to destroy the tunnels. These powers will be introduced to the Palestinian side that they decide should take over when all is ready. And we've seen a lot of back and forth to make this palatable and acceptable. The crux of all of this is that America is the one that wants to arrange the structures in the way that they see fit. Now, what does America not want? They don't want any Palestinian formation that is independent. If we just put the resistance on the side for a moment, even the PLO, you know, the Palestinian Liberation Organization that was formed by Yasser Arafat, which we had the PA that came out of Oslo, even that in its current form is rejected by America and the Israeli occupation entity, despite the fact that Israel itself was the signatory to the Oslo Accords. And we saw that Palestine fulfilled its side, but the Israeli occupation entity didn't fulfill their side. So the PA is rejected. You know, Israel reached a point of annexing the West Bank despite, you know, the Oslo Accords splitting it up into areas A, B, C, etc. And that goes to the heart of the matter, and that is because the PA was not their creation, despite the fact that the PA takes orders from the Israeli occupation entity and follows them. But ultimately, they want to form the authority in control. Of course, in all of this, the resistance is also rejected, which is inherently a part and parcel of the people, and the people have made their decision. We've seen it clear in the past 2 years from the people of Gaza that they stand with the resistance as well.
Right, I want to continue another conversation, bringing Ajamu to the conversation. Really, how can an externally mandated stabilization force, a so-called ISF, ever be legitimate without the consent of the people it is going to rule on?
It can't be. This is what makes this whole proposal so unserious, that this is a idea that is bound to fail because it continues to sideline the representatives of the Palestinian people themselves. I think this will be a dark date in the history of the United Nations when it becomes clear, I think it's already clear, that the United Nations has basically allowed itself to be bullied by the United States of America into, in essence, surrendering its legitimacy and its power to the United States of America. This idea that the U.S. should have the authority to, along with the Israeli fascists that created the genocide and continued the occupation, the idea that they should be allowed to govern a Palestinian people who are involved in a legitimate struggle of decolonization, a struggle that has as its objective self-determination, it puts the United Nations on the side of the colonizer. This is a absolute departure from the values and the principles of the United Nations and its charter. So this is absolutely outrageous and should be rejected by most of the nations on this planet.
Right, and Batul, considering the different dimensions of this new resolution, which has gone past, UN Security Council, how much do you think it risks becoming a new form of trusteeship or colonial administration, under international cover?
Yes. Ultimately, this goes to the crux of what we're seeing in the region. The whole region is colonized and not stabilized. This needs to be made clear. When we look at Gaza today, more than half of it is already occupied by Israel. So it's not a matter of the ISF risking becoming a colonial administration. The whole of Gaza is besieged today. If you look at even its neighbors, you look at Lebanon, you look at Syria, they're routinely bombed. You look at the Persian Gulf countries, you look at Egypt, you look at Saudi Arabia, they operate under a form of American colonialism in that they are under American dictates. Today, the whole region, this phase of US colonization in the region is at its worst phase, because America today is fully calling the shots in terms of how to deal, what is considered acceptable, what isn't. It seeks to get the world's countries to bow with different kinds of excuses. And if we look even beyond continents, from Venezuela to Cuba, using the excuse of the war on drugs, in Lebanon today, we see the American paper openly being called as such, and that it needs to be enacted under threats or else Lebanon will be invaded. Today, America is the one giving the dictates and outlining its visions and what it wants to be fulfilled. And we see those dictates, for example, I gave the example of Lebanon, being given to the Lebanese army that is funded by the US. You know, we see it canceling its scheduled meetings with the Lebanese army commander because, Lebanon's statement is clearly blaming Israel for its tensions rather than the resistance.
Right.
But today, what we see is the political and military hegemony is from the US. The structures are theirs. The leadership is theirs, as they want it in Gaza, and they decide who fulfills what. So today in Gaza, they want to give the reconstruction to the Persian Gulf countries, the money from them. You have troops in the ISF, they're talking about troops from Islamic countries supposedly being integrated. They want to almost create a contradiction here between even Muslim governments and the people. So we see the decisions of the Security Council ultimately within this framework, which are all inherently colonial.
Right. Achamo, the UN, of course, it's called United Nations. It is supposed to be independent. How do you think it can reconcile stabilization with the principle of self-determination so enshrined in its own charter?
It's impossible. And that's really the point. That basically this is a significant departure from the United Nations charter. This is historic in its implications. And so, as the guest just indicated, this is a reflection of the new power dynamics that basically over the last 2 years, what we have seen unfold in West Asia has been a program of domination, a program that had at the center of its objective the reestablishment of U.S. hegemony in the region, operating through its proxy, Fort Israel. And we the vote the other day in the United Nations was just a culmination of this process. So these principles cannot be reconciled, and that's why they are bound to fail. What is going to be the role of this international stabilization force if the resistance continues, and it will continue? Will they be given a mandate to go in shooting and murdering Palestinian people? This is something that it is unworkable. And again, it's something that we should reject. The only legitimate force that can be inserted is a force under the command of the United Nations with the full cooperation and permission given by the representatives of the Palestinian people themselves. Anything short of that is colonialization.
Right, and Batul, how will this ISF going to engage with de facto local authorities without legitimizing armed control or excluding constituencies?
Right, so within the UN resolution, I mean, there's several things, right? You have that Board of Peace, and then you have the ISF that's overseen by it, and the idea is that it would coordinate with Egypt and the Israeli occupation forces, and their job ultimately would be to train the Palestinians that they want and that they bring to then control the strip. So they are a police state, you know, made up of countries, and one of its jobs is to hit the existing infrastructure that they seek to get rid of. And you also have a Palestinian executive committee, this is outlined within the resolution, that manages the day-to-day governance within the Gaza Strip. So basically technocrats taking care of the civil administration of the state, again, in coordination between Egypt and the Israeli occupation entity. And within that, you have supporting nations like Qatar, Turkey, Egypt, and the US. One important point that I want to raise over here, when we talk about, you know, like the second phase, is, you know, even this 52% of Gaza that is occupied now by Israel, it is clear from this resolution that Israel will not withdraw and will not leave until there is this alternative force ready to govern within the American structure, American created. And all of this means that the second phase, including the withdrawal of the IOF, is hanging and is not bound by time, but by procedures that are very difficult to actualize, because its actualization includes removal of the Gazan resistance. And what does disarmament even mean? You know, what does it mean to destroy the tunnels? What could not be achieved during those 2 years of exercising the maximum degree of force it can apply on Gaza in terms of achieving its objectives? Israel will not be able to achieve during a time of peace. So it will not eliminate the resistance, no part of it, nor its supportive environment. And the mere existence and continuation of the idea and of those who carry the idea of resistance and who remain steadfast on this land means that even the political negotiations cannot replace the military force in extracting what is sought to be extracted. And in the ongoing and existing crisis in Palestine, that is, we're seeing a transformation occurring within the active internal situation that is rejecting this reality. For example, never at any point in time was the resistance able to recruit the number of fighters that it's able to recruit now.
Well, of course, Adjamo, I want to talk a little bit about the European Union. Well, the collective West seems to be of a unified stance when it comes to this resolution. But at the same time, the European Union has warned against any changes in the demographic or the territorial integrity of Gaza and Palestine. Where does this concern come from, do you think?
Well, I mean, it comes from their insistence on this fiction of a two-state solution. And I say fiction because the Israeli authorities have made it quite clear that they oppose any Palestinian state anywhere in the region. So where is the basis of peace, and where is the basis of a so-called two-state solution? So this is a continuation of Oslo, a continuation of the fiction that the European nations are committed to Palestinian rights in a Palestinian state. The historic experience suggests to us that we can't really take them seriously, that basically they are in alignment with the interests of the U.S. They will articulate some concerns because of their attempts to try to continue to pretend to be the defenders of international law and human rights. Gaza has exposed the true nature, not only of the Israeli occupation and the Israeli colonial project, but it stripped away any veneer that the West had any kind of commitment to anything called human rights and international law.
Right, Adjamo, I want to continue this with you. You mentioned the two-state solution, which is like what the European Union wants and insists on. How do you think this two-state solution goes along with the transitional governance form and model that has been designated for this ISF?
It's impossible to, they can't reconcile these two ideals, because basically, if you are not prepared to allow the Palestinians to exercise authentic self-determination, then there's no solution. There's no peace process. That's why it's a misnomer to even refer to this as a peace process. This is a demand for the surrendering of the Palestinian resistance. This is a demand that any aspirations for Palestinian self-determination be abandoned. What is unique about this process is that we have a situation developing where you have sort of a new creation of a whole colonial administration, that the Israelis have been almost forced to give up some degree of control over Gaza,
right,
to the interest of the United States of America.
Right. And Batul, I want to focus on Russia and China's role. And they abstained rather than like voting negative to this resolution. I want to talk, I want you to tell me, what do you think? How does this reflect wider concerns regarding the implementation and implications of this resolution on the future of Palestine?
Right. I mean, Russia and China abstaining, I mean, ultimately that means they, at the heart of it, were against this resolution, but they don't have alternatives, and they also have reservations. Ultimately, this proves to me even more the point that, practically speaking, this plan of America will not work. And ultimately, that's because the Palestinians have proven that they will not accept to be besieged and occupied, and that's what October the 7th was a result of. But at the same time, no one should expect the liberation in Palestine to come from anywhere other than the Palestinians themselves. I mean, in 2 years of a genocide, we've not seen China reduce its trade relations with the Israeli occupation entity, which is its largest trade partner. I mean, in 2024 alone, like, the total goods trade between the entity and China was up to 16 billion, and it was up around 10% from 2023, and its imports actually rose in 2024. And likewise with Russia, I mean, Russia has its interests with the occupation entity too. You have its, you know, Zionist Jewish oligarchs within Russia. You've got over 1 million, you know, citizens of the Israeli occupation entity who also have Russian citizenship. So ultimately, it's shown that Russia and China are not willing to upset the United States of America when it comes to this, and they're almost waiting for the battle to come to their yard, if you will, in order to stand up and to take this kind of action. So ultimately, no liberation for Palestine will happen except at the hands of the Palestinians, and the Palestinians have proven that they are absolutely steadfast, and they will not give up. And we know that occupations, transgressions, torture, besiegement, they're all tools of savagery that are practiced against the Palestinian nation so it can remain isolated and has nothing. But resistance emerging and solidifying itself is very natural. It's not natural for there to be no resistance based on the extent of the transgression that is occurring. And if we look at the results, I mean, the Oslo Accords happened 3 decades ago, and October the 7th happened 3 decades after it. So occupation will only breed resistance, and even international law itself gives legitimacy to armed resistance as a reaction to occupation. And ultimately, the whole world today is at a completely different place due to this confrontation. The world has woken up.
Right, Ajamo, I want to talk a little bit about the operational mechanics of this ISF ruling model. What mechanisms, with Egypt and Israel controlling the borders, will be the, without entrenching, external control over Palestinian free movement?
Well, I mean, the control will be total. And I'm more concerned about the so-called training of a force internally within the Gaza Strip by Egypt and the occupation forces. Because that spells a force that would be completely in opposition to the Palestinian people themselves. There's nothing about this plan that makes any real sense, that these folks seem to be operating in an alternative universe. And you know, the very fact that we have to give this some time and some degree of legitimacy, you know, it just sort of compounds the fact that, you know, these forces have the ability to recreate reality, if you will. But in their attempt to do that, They devise processes and policies that undermine their own objectives. They're not going to be able to implement this plan, this so-called peace plan in Gaza. The history of anti-colonial struggles have supported that. So basically what we're going to see now is a continuation of the suffering of the Palestinian people. And we're going to see, I think, a certain kind of destabilization taking place even in some of those states that have signed on to this fictional process.
Right, and it's very unfortunate, of course, to hear and to witness. Well, Batul, one final question for you. How will the mission ensure compliance with international humanitarian law and avoid actions resembling occupation?
None, simply because it's impossible. America is in charge.
Now, go ahead, Batul. I wanted you to answer this question.
Absolutely, and I echo exactly what the guest has just said. It's absolutely impossible to ascertain that because we've just had 2 years of genocide in which it was perpetrated by America that is putting this supposed peace plan forward. So the one that is orchestrating it ultimately is the one who perpetrated the genocide. It's crazy, right? They come under the guise of peace. So all of a sudden now they're talking about peace, whereas they were the proponents of the genocide. And now they're talking about reconstruction and making something out of Gaza when these weapons, Israel could not have conducted this genocide for one day without the American support. So it's absolutely impossible. And what do we expect to see? We expect to see further resistance and the Palestinians remaining steadfast.
Right, and one final question for Ajamu. Of course, will there be any independent bodies investigating alleged abuses by all actors, including the ISF?
There should be. I mean, this should fall under the authority, under the auspices of the United Nations Human Rights Council. You have, of course, the special rapporteur. So there should be, close scrutiny, because we anticipate nothing but the continuation of violence, not at the level of the last 2 years, perhaps, but violence nevertheless. And this is a situation that suggests to us that in the end, we're going to have an explosion, not only in Gaza itself, but across West Asia, when the masses of the people understand the collusion that their states have been involved in, collusion with the collective West against the Palestinian people, and the indignity of that, we're going to see, I think, massive political destabilization across West Asia.
Right, thank you so much. It was indeed a pleasure to have you on this program. Ajamu Baraka, founder of Black Alliance for Peace, joining us from New York, and Batul Sobeti, activist and political analyst, joining us from London. Now, the ISF in Gaza embodies a profound tension, stabilization for some, colonialization for others. This spotlight leaves open the question of whether international intervention can truly secure peace without eroding Palestinian sovereignty. Thank you, Ayan Bahman Roy.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here, we enlighten you with the ayah 61 of Surah Yunus, recited by Ahmad Mirza Tawqifi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وما تكون في شأن وما وَمَا